True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Those of you who may want to ask, let me address very directly, I did not kill my daughter, JonBenet. There have also been innuendos that she has been or was sexually molested. I can tell you those were the most hurtful innuendos to us as a family. They are totally false. JonBenet and I had a very close relationship. I will miss her dearly for the rest of my life.
I'm appalled that anyone would think that John or I would be involved in such a hideous, heinous crime. But let me assure you that I did not kill JonBenet. I did not have anything to do with it. I love that child with my whole of my heart and soul.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. This holiday season, give the gift of safety with Saber, the number one brand of pepper spray used by police and consumers worldwide. Saber offers maximum strength pepper spray and gel, as well as some other great devices to keep everyone safe this season and throughout the year. Their attention-grabbing personal alarms are audible up to 1,000 feet away, which is truly exceptional. They also have easy-to-install home security options, great for those of us who aren't very handy around the house. Go to saberred.com/truecrimebrewery and use code TRUECRIME to get 20% off your order. That's saberred.com/truecrimebrewery.
JonBenet Ramsey was 6 years old when she was found murdered in the basement of her Boulder, Colorado home on the day after Christmas. 22 years later, her murder remains unsolved. The reason why there has been no conviction in this case could be attributed to mistakes made by the Boulder Police Department right from the beginning of their investigation, and to what many people define as a lack of cooperation by JonBenet's parents, John and Patsy Ramsey. There are only two possible answers to what happened that night. One is that an intruder crept into the house, killed JonBenet in a botched kidnapping attempt while the family slept, and then took off, leaving behind a 3-page ransom note. The other possibility is that she was killed by a family member. In going over the physical and circumstantial evidence in the case, we'll address the mistakes in the police investigation that have hindered a conviction and allowed a child killer to remain free, before we examine the theories of what actually happened in the Ramsey house that night. So I hear through the grapevine that you have a Boulder beer for us today.
I do. Remember, we were there in the fall doing some research for this particular podcast. I mean, it's such a famous case.
Exactly, yes.
So we went up there and I had a IPA called FY IPA at the Mountain Sun Pub and Brewery in Boulder. And I know I said I wasn't going to do IPAs for a while, but how could I pass this up? A Boulder beer.
Well, no. It's from Boulder, so I'm going to give you a pass.
Thanks. So FY IPA is a copper-colored beer, very thick white head, a lot of clingy lace on the glass, very good-looking beer. Nice aroma, citrus mostly, some pine, a little bit of sweet malt in the background. This translates into an orange taste, maybe a little orange peel, some pine, and a nice caramel background to it. Nice beer. So let's head on down.
Well, let's open it up and then head on down.
All right.
How's that?
We can do that.
Okay. All right, down here at the quiet end, I think because it's the holiday, it's a little bit quieter even than usual.
It is. I mean, all the Santas are done with their work, so they aren't hanging out here anymore.
No, they're not.
They're heading back to the North Pole.
Yeah. So why don't you go ahead and get us started then?
So JonBenet Ramsey was born in August 1990 in Atlanta, Georgia. She was a bottle-fed baby. And in fact, she drank from a bottle well beyond the time she turned 3 years old. For the most part, she was considered to be a quiet child, but she was capable of having the occasional temper tantrum. Well, sure, she's a kid.
Sure.
The Ramseys moved from Atlanta to Colorado just after JonBenet's first birthday. John and Patsy purchased a huge house in Boulder, which Patsy decorated lavishly. So they've got this beautiful house, wealthy husband.
Sure.
He made a lot of money.
He did, millions.
So shortly after the move, Patsy was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And as she went through chemo, she took the bedroom next to JonBenet's. JonBenet attended a preschool program at her church, and she was in the Daisy Troop of the Boulder Girl Scouts. Her summers were spent in another large family home in Charlevoix, Michigan, where she'd swim in a lake, ride her bike, rollerblade. And she did participate in beauty pageants, but she was a tomboy at heart and just loved to play outdoors and get down and dirty.
Yeah, which I think is important to note, that she didn't always look like that painted-up little version that you see on the news shows.
I always think of that as, you know, you see those pictures, she's all tarted up.
Yeah. You don't like it?
No.
You think it's bad for kids to do that?
Well, and I don't have any specific stuff. Maybe it's me, maybe it's just the pediatrician in me. But I look at this stuff, at least the extent that JonBenet is participating in it, as a form of child abuse.
Well, I think you're not the only one. I think there is a general feeling among people that it's not the right thing to do. I mean, look at that movie Little Miss Sunshine. That sure painted it in a horrible light, these beauty pageants. Although I'm sure there are some people that say it was good for them.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
And her mom was deeply rooted in this beauty pageant stuff.
Right. I mean, in some communities, it's kind of a normal thing to do.
Yeah.
But I can see how it might not be all positive. But like you said, it was destined to happen because Patsy and JonBenet's Aunt Pam also had won the Miss West Virginia pageant, and they both competed for Miss America when they were younger.
Right. Neither of them won.
No. Now, in 1994, Patsy and her mom, Nedra, decided it would be a good idea for JonBenet to compete after they visited a Little Miss America contest. JonBenet was only 4 when she was put out on the circuit, as they call it. She had her first win in Michigan, where she performed singing and tap dancing, and she was crowned Little Miss Charlevoix. In October 1995, she was Little Miss Colorado Sunburst. And in the 1995 Boulder Christmas Parade, she sang on a float named the Good Ship Lollipop. She seemed to enjoy the pageants for the most part, but when she got tired of it, she would be reprimanded by Patsy or by her grandmother. She was taught from a young age that she should want to win in the pageants, and she was told to give 100% to win. A family friend would recall one time when they were in a restaurant after a pageant where JonBenet was cold and she wanted to put on a sweater. And Patsy wouldn't let her. She told JonBenet, "You're still on show." So I don't like that. That gives me a bad feeling.
Well, this just is an example of the things I don't like about beauty pageants for little kids.
Well, you know, I don't really particularly like any kind of pageant with anyone walking around being judged by how they look, whether it's a child, a woman, a man, anybody,
right.
Even dogs and horses. I don't like it.
Yeah, but here's this 4, 5, 6-year-old kid. If she expresses anything contrary to being in a pageant, she got yelled at.
Yeah, it is particularly abusive for a child because they're not really making that decision, are they?
No.
But of course, having all the money that they had helped in her success. She had a huge wardrobe, and she took lots of lessons, different talent lessons, singing, dancing, all that stuff.
JonBenet also had a bedwetting problem, and she would occasionally defecate, both in her bed and in her underwear as well.
So obviously, Patsy didn't appreciate that, because that's not something a beauty queen does.
Heck no. But they're not that uncommon.
Well, in the whole bedwetting, I've heard a lot of programs that I've looked into before we did this case about how bedwetting was very unusual, but I don't think it's that unusual for a 6-year-old to still wet the bed at night. That's
no.
Why pull-ups are selling so well.
It's not.
No.
I mean, I heard the same stuff, that it might indicate some depression or some other underlying disorder. But, you know, we saw tons of kids, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 even, that continue to wet the bed.
Well, and there is a physiological problem many times for it, right?
Well, typically, yeah.
Yeah, and what is that?
Well, basically, it's what happens is that the kid doesn't feel the signals of a full bladder. And so they don't wake up sufficiently to get out of bed and pee. But with time, and something like if we look at the numbers of bedwetters, each year there's 10 to 15% fewer kids that wet the bed. And by the time they're 11 or 12, pretty much everybody's done wetting the bed.
So it's not necessarily a sign of a psychological problem for her.
No.
Not at all.
I didn't even look at it that way when I saw kids that wet.
So that wouldn't be the first thing you'd go to at all?
No, it isn't. Now, the defecation part is something called encopresis, which is kind of involuntary stooling. And the usual reason for this is that the child is relatively constipated from holding stool. So you have to go to the bathroom, you try to pass a stool, and it hurts. So you hold it in, and that just starts the ball rolling. So each time you have the urge to defecate, it hurts, so you try to hold it in. And what will happen is you build up enough stool, you'll start having some leakage around the edges of the stool that's accumulated there. You'll get some soiling of the underwear or even passage of little chunks. Usually what you need to do with that is do a clean out of the colon, get the muscle tone back in the lower bowel so that you can stool comfortably when you feel like you have to go.
So the important thing here is that there could be just simple physiological reasons for her doing this.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And the other way they go together is if you've got a lower intestine, the lower part of the small bowel and the rectum full of stool, what's right next door to that? The bladder. So this bunch of stool in the intestine kind of pushes on the bladder and makes you have to wet. So they go together.
Well, I think that's important to note because it's been looked at as a possible sign that she was abused, sexually abused, that she was under so much pressure with the pageants, but that's not necessarily true. Now, another thing of note is that Jean-Benet had frequent colds and coughs, but that was eventually diagnosed as allergic rhinitis. Any comments on that? Is that pretty common?
Very common.
And in 1995, she tripped and fell in a grocery store where she bruised her nose and didn't break it. And 6 months later, she fell again and bruised her left eye. So these seem like normal childhood accidents. That doesn't seem like anything excessive or odd to me. But I do think it's kind of interesting that in 2 years, the 2 years leading up to her death, she did see the doctor 18 times.
Yeah, that's a lot.
That is a lot, isn't it?
I would see some kids that frequently. But usually, at this age, you're having one checkup a year, one physical exam per year. And if you're relatively healthy, that might be the only time you're into the doc. So one visit a year. Let's say maybe a few other illnesses, so 3 or 4, but 9 visits per year. So a lot of visits.
Yeah. Okay, well, notification of something happening at the Ramsey house on the morning after Christmas Day came in at 5:52 a.m., and that's when Patsy called 911. So before we move forward, let's just listen to the 911 call.
911 emergency.
Hurry, wait a minute. Police.
What's going on?
515th Street.
What's going on there, ma'am?
We have a kidnapping. Hurry, please.
Explain to me what's going on, okay?
No, there's a note left and our daughter's gone.
A note was left and your daughter's gone?
Yeah.
How old is your daughter?
6 years old. She's gone. 6 years old.
How long ago was it?
I don't know. I just found the note. And my daughter's kids
are saying who took her?
What?
Is it saying who took her?
I don't know. There's a ransom note here.
It's a ransom note?
It says FBTC. Victory. Please.
Okay, what's your name? Are you
Kathy Ramsey? I'm the mother. Oh my God! Please.
I'm sending an officer over, okay?
Please.
Do you know how long she's been gone?
No, I don't. Please, we just got out. Is she on here? Oh my God, please.
Okay,
please, is she, honey?
I am, honey.
Please.
Take a deep breath.
Please, okay? Hurry.
Kathy?
Okay, so anything unusual stand out to you in that call?
So, some of the language. We have a kidnapping. Not my daughter's missing. That comes later, but we have a kidnapping. It was something that raised my eyebrows a little bit. That's pretty much it. What else?
Well, I just think that I think it sounded pretty acceptable. I mean, I don't find anything that really stands out. I guess the only thing to really remark on here is that at the end there were various people who heard other things. For example, when we read the book by Steve Thomas, one of the detectives, he clarified that they were certain they heard Burke speaking at the end of the call in the background. Now, one thing the 911 dispatcher said that she noticed was when Patsy thought she'd hung up, but she could still hear them talking, she thought that her whole affect changed, that the whole panicked, worried thing went away, and that she heard other things in the background. Now, the documentary that we watched, The Case of JonBenet Ramsey, with the people from True Crime Profile, Jim Clemente and Laura, right now I can't think of her last name. But anyway, when they played the 911 call, they heard other things, and they did have it enhanced as well. And they thought that they heard John Ramsey say to someone, "We're not talking to you right now." But they lied because they said that Burke was in bed the whole time.
Yeah, and there's a strong possibility that he hadn't been in bed the whole time.
Correct, yes.
So when the dispatcher called for Patrol Unit 273 of the Boulder Police Department, they were just wrapping up their night shift. The report was that a ransom note had been found and a 6-year-old girl was missing. Now, this is not quite dawn yet. There's pretty much zero traffic. So the officer, who is Rick French, he got to the house within just minutes. Now, his arrival was the first of many mistakes that the Boulder Police Department would make in this case.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, we'll go through this as we get to it. But the first thing is that you've got a kidnapping with a ransom note. And we know that. We know that Patsy said there's been a kidnapping.
Yes.
So an unmarked car or undercover officers should have been the ones responding to the kidnapping, not a black and white car. Now, in his defense, Officer French had no idea about the warnings in the ransom note. However, if the alleged kidnappers had been watching the house, they would have known that police had been called. And that was one of the things that the Ramseys were told not to do, that JonBenet would be killed if they went to the police.
So that's another thing about the call. Why wouldn't Patsy have said, "They can't know that we called the police, or they say they're going to hurt her, kill her"?
Well, that, but I mean, the police should have a protocol for that anyway.
Oh, absolutely. But I just think it's strange that Patsy didn't mention it.
Yeah, right. So Officer French walked up to the house, which was decorated with large candy canes and little cute white lights. He was met at the front door by a distraught Patsy, who was wearing black pants and a red sweater. Although it was still before dawn, her hair was neatly done, and she had her makeup on.
So this, to me, is a huge red flag. Why? Early in the morning, you wake up, your daughter is missing, you find this ransom note. Why would you be fully dressed? And not just fully dressed, but dressed in the clothes she wore the day before, we'll find out.
Yeah, that's another issue, or something that will arise from that.
Yeah, so they were joined at the door by John Ramsey, and he was wearing a long-sleeved blue and white striped shirt and some khaki pants. Patsy and John told the officer that their daughter JonBenet was missing and their 9-year-old son was still asleep upstairs. So they led French through the foyer and the kitchen area to the back hallway, where 3 pages of white legal tablet paper covered with blocky handwriting were actually spread out on the wooden floor.
And why on the floor? Why didn't they put it on a countertop or something?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
So let's just read through the letter. You read the first part and I'll read the second part.
Okay. So the note read, "Mr. Ramsey, listen carefully. We are a group of individuals that represent a small foreign faction. We do respect your business," misspelled, "but not the country that it serves. At this time, we have your daughter in our possession," also misspelled. "She is safe and unharmed, and if you want her to see 1997, you must follow our instructions to the letter. You will withdraw $118,000 from your account. $100,000 will be in $100 bills, and the remaining $18,000 in $20 bills. make sure that you bring an adequate size attaché to the bank. When you get home, you will put the money in a brown paper bag. I will call you between 8 and 10 a.m. tomorrow to instruct you on delivery. The delivery will be exhausting, so I advise you to be rested. If we monitor you getting the money early, we might call you early to arrange an earlier delivery of the money, and hence a earlier delivery pickup of your daughter. Any deviation of my instructions will result in the immediate execution of your daughter. You will also be denied her remains for proper burial. The two gentlemen watching over your daughter do not particularly like you, so I advise you not to provoke them.
Speaking to anyone about your situation, such as police, FBI, etc., will result in your daughter being beheaded. If we catch you talking to a stray dog, she dies. If you alert bank authorities, she dies. If the money is in any way marked or tampered with, she dies. You will be scanned for electronic devices, and if any are found, she dies. You can try to deceive us, but be warned that we are familiar with law enforcement countermeasures and tactics. You stand a 99% chance of killing your daughter if you try to outsmart us. Follow our instructions and you stand a 100% chance of getting her back. You and your family are under constant scrutiny, as well as the authorities. Don't try to grow a brain, John. You are not the only fat cat around, so don't think that killing will be difficult. Don't underestimate us, John. Use that good Southern common sense of yours. It is up to you now, John. Victory. SBTC. So where do we start with this?
Well, there's a lot of things, huh?
Yeah. I mean, let's just start with the simple things like the length of the letter.
Well, it's a 2.5, almost 3-page letter. So if I'm the kidnapper, I probably need one paragraph to get my point across to the Ramseys, but it takes them 2.5 pages. The amount of money is weird. I mean, this is a very wealthy guy. So the kidnappers ought to be asking for $5 million or something like that.
Right, right.
A big amount of money. $118,000 is chicken feed for Ramsey. The other interesting thing, and I guess you'll talk about that sometime, this is pretty much the exact amount that he had gotten from his company as a Christmas bonus.
Yeah, that's a hell of a bonus, by the way.
Well, he worked hard.
Yeah, I guess so.
But anyway, the amount of money is just weird.
But it certainly makes clear that the police shouldn't be notified, that no one should be notified.
Right.
Right?
It does.
And also, there are parts of it that actually sound like they come from a film. There was a film out not that long before this. I think it was called Ransom, about a kidnapping of this sort. And a lot of the language is similar. Now, another thing, what does SBTC mean?
Well, no one's been able to say for sure, but one possible explanation, and one I like, is SBTC stands for Saved by the Cross. It's an acronym. It represents victory over Satan.
Hmm, okay.
Now, we're going to talk about how the handwriting in the ransom note closely matched Patsy's handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
So, leading us to believe that she was the author of the note, or at least she was the one who wrote the note. Maybe she wasn't the author. Maybe someone dictated it to her.
That's a possibility,
But she likely wrote the note. And she is a pretty religious person.
Yeah, she was, yep.
So that could be. I like that one. The other thing that people have suggested, SBTC, stood for Subic Bay Training Center, which is where John Ramsey had been stationed when he finished school. And he was in the military.
That doesn't make a lot of sense, though. Unless we're trying to say that these people are from his time there, and that's how they knew him. I don't know about that.
Yeah, although at the time he was there, he was just on his first marriage. John Binet wasn't anywhere in existence.
Okay.
At that. So, I don't know. I think if I'm going to say that Patsy Ramsey was the writer of the note, and I am.
All right. Get that out right up front, I guess.
And knowing how religious she was, Saved by the Cross makes a lot of sense to me.
That does make some sense when you think about it. Well, Patsy told Officer French that she had gone into JonBenet's bedroom at 5:45 a.m. to awaken her because the family planned to fly to Michigan that morning. The bedroom was empty, and when she walked down the back spiral staircase, she found the note on the third step from the bottom, which the placement of the note is odd, I believe, as well. Why wouldn't it be on a countertop or a table?
Right, and the other thing is you had to be familiar with the house to know where to put that.
Yeah, we have to remember this was a big, winding house with all these different little rooms.
This was a 7,000-foot house.
Yeah.
Huge house.
And not an open floor plan at all.
No. And there's a front staircase, kind of a grand staircase. So if there was a kidnapper, the letter ought to go there or someplace prominent. It's almost as if they had to know that Patsy Ramsey would use the back stair, the spiral staircase.
Yeah, I could agree with that. So John Ramsey said that he had checked the house, and it appeared to still be locked as he had left it the night before. He saw no sign of forced entry. The alarm system, he said, had not been turned on, and their small dog had spent the night at a neighbor's house. And the Ramseys had heard nothing unusual during the night. So French stepped away from them when Sergeant Reichenbach arrived at the front door, and he confirmed that it looked as if there might have actually been a kidnapping. But he added, something just isn't right. So right away, he felt like this was weird. I think these kinds of kidnappings are very unusual anyway, and this one's very peculiar.
This one is. If you look at it as a random, couldn't have been a random kidnapping, could it?
Well, no, they knew who he was and that he had money, sure.
But they live in a pretty exclusive neighborhood, and strangers would be noticed.
Yes, I think so.
So this is all going on. In the meantime, Patsy had already made two more telephone calls just after contacting the police. This was done despite the explicit warning in the ransom note that JonBenet would be beheaded if Patsy spoke to anyone. So Patsy called her friends Fleet and Priscilla White. These are the people that had the party that the Ramsey family had attended Christmas night. Then she alerted two other close friends, John and Barbara Fernie, and all four were asked to hurry over to the Ramsey home, which they did. So if kidnappers had been watching, the sudden arrival of two police cars and several friends would have told them the warnings in their note were being ignored.
Well, absolutely.
So there's explicit warnings in the note what's going to happen to JonBenet.
Yeah, that's hugely strange.
And Patsy and John totally disregarded those.
Yeah. Now, Reichenbach read the ransom note, and the patrol sergeant knew he was going to need a lot more help. And on the day after Christmas, he knew that would be difficult because every cop who could get the time off for the holidays would have. So they only had the minimum number of officers on duty that night.
Yeah, the proverbial skeleton crew. Nobody was there.
So Officer French called for more officers, crime scene technicians, and victim advocates. He alerted the phone company to put a tap on the Ramsey phone and notified the on-call detective supervisor, Sergeant Bob Whitson. Further radio communication was ordered to stop to prevent the kidnappers from picking up the police broadcasts if they had a scanner. So as other police showed up, they were puzzled by the behavior of the parents. Now, John seemed calm and composed, but he wasn't comforting Patsy, who was lying alone on the floor in a nearby room. She was hugging pillows, clutching a crucifix, and crying. And then she was surrounded by her friends as well as they arrived.
Right. She had her posse helping her. So Officer Reichenbach and John Ramsey went up to the second floor to look in JonBenet's bedroom. In this room, there were two beds that were parallel to each other, about 3 feet apart. One was made, and the other's comforter was pulled back, which showed a white fitted sheet with cartoon characters on it. There was a large Christmas tree decorated with angels and snowflakes that stood beside the curtains of a closed door leading to a covered balcony. Dolls and clothes were all over the room. Closet doors on the opposite wall were open, showing more clothes on hangers and in piles on the floor. On a wall above a white chest of drawers, there was a formal portrait of JonBenet, smiling with her chin resting on lace-gloved hands.
We've all seen this picture in the media.
Everyone's seen it. John Ramsey lifted the dust ruffle to look under the bed. He was told not to touch anything else. As they left the room, the phone rang and John Ramsey answered.
Yeah, so the officer heard John say, "JonBenet's been kidnapped," and then he began crying. The lights were off in the nearby bedroom of JonBenet's brother Burke, and Reichenbach looked in on him. He appeared to be asleep, so he closed the door. I don't understand why he would do that. What if JonBenet was hiding under the bed? The whole way this is handled is strange.
It's not really a search, is it?
Well, it should be, though, shouldn't it?
They should comb through the house to make sure.
I would think so, and maybe not have the father along with them.
No, they shouldn't have the father alone. He's a suspect until proven otherwise.
But Burke appeared to be asleep, so the policeman closed the door, and he found no evidence of forced entry when he did a walk through the house. But like we said, this was not a detailed search. Then he went outside, and there was a light dusting of snow and frost that was lying over some earlier crusty snow patches on the lawn. He saw no fresh shoe impressions. He found no open doors or windows, nothing to show him that there had been a break-in. So next he went down into this huge basement and walked through that. But again, this was not a detailed search, I don't believe. At the far end, there was a white door secured at the top by a block of wood on a screw, and Reichenbach tried to open that door, but stopped when he felt resistance and then just went back upstairs.
So he never opened the door?
No.
Like you said, a half-assed search.
Sure is. So Reichenbach, Officer French, and one of Patsy's friends, Fleet White, all checked that white door in the basement that morning. Fleet White would say that he did open it, but none of them found anything.
Yeah, but the room, we read this, the light switch to that room was kind of hidden away. You had to pretty much know where it was to find it. And there was so little light in the room, you could open the door and look into the room and not see anything.
Right, exactly. So by the time the sun came up at 6:30, the Whites and the Fernies had arrived to comfort the Ramseys. Now their entrance into the house was also a big mistake. This home was a crime scene, apparently a kidnapping at that point, but they're just allowing people to walk in.
Yeah, because standard police procedure would have been to empty the house immediately and take the family members to the police station, post a patrol officer inside the front door, and allow entry only to authorized personnel. Then they should have set up a perimeter some distance away from the house to preserve the area.
Well, no one knew at this point what evidence might still be found. The crime scene was at risk by allowing these friends to come in. Fleet White stepped away from the group around the Ramseys and took a walk around the house. No one told him not to. His own little girl had temporarily disappeared the year before, and he remembered the fear that he had felt when he couldn't find her, but then she was just found hiding somewhere. So Fleet went downstairs, and the lights were on. There was a small broken window in a room where a model railroad was laid out, and that caught his attention. And on the floor beneath the window, he found a piece of glass, which he picked up and put on the ledge. Then he got on his hands and knees and searched for other pieces, and he moved a suitcase. Unknowingly, he was altering a big part of the crime scene. So by 6:45 a.m., two victim advocates from the police department arrived. 5 minutes later, as the crime scene tech was dusting for fingerprints, one of the advocates followed along behind them, tidying up with a spray cleaner and a cloth. So possible trace evidence was being erased at this point.
Yeah, well, again, who's in charge here, right?
We don't know, right?
I mean, well, apparently no one. But I just can't believe they were allowed to have people come over, traipse through the house, totally destroying any evidence that might have been there.
Yeah, and it gets worse.
It does.
Another technician saw the ransom note on the bottom step of the spiral staircase and photographed it there. Now, the note had already been removed from the stairs by Patsy's hands and then had been spread out on the hallway floor by John Ramsey, and police had read it and put it back on the step. So this photo, which was supposed to show where evidence had been found, was completely inaccurate. The pastor of St. John's Episcopal Church arrived at the house and was also allowed into the home, adding to this crowd. Police mistakes continued, and the crime scene was completely messed up. No one took control, and the scene was compromised before they could even begin the investigation. The main witnesses in the Ramsey investigation were Patsy and John Ramsey, and their 9-year-old son, Burke. Those are the only other people in the house. When JonBenet was reported missing, the police should have immediately woken up Burke and questioned him to see if he had heard or seen anything during the night. Unfortunately, neither the police nor the parents thought it was necessary to wake up Burke to find out if he'd heard anything or if he knew anything. One of the strangest moments of that morning occurred when John Ramsey woke Burke, got him dressed, and sent him to be taken out of the house to a family friend's house. Now, as Burke was a key witness, the police should not have let him be escorted away from the house, no matter how much John insisted that his son was sleeping and didn't know anything. Why would they just take his word? I kind of feel like a lot of this behavior was just based on the fact that John Ramsey was this wealthy, powerful guy, and maybe the police were a little intimidated by that?
Possibly. I mean, the other thing is that there's apparently not, or at least at the time, there weren't very many homicides in Boulder. So maybe they just didn't know how to investigate one.
But come on, there's training.
Yeah, I know. So we've gotten to where we're hours after the investigation beginning. And they still haven't done an official walkthrough of the house. Now, this is standard police procedure, but they hadn't done it yet. Scene walkthroughs are invaluable to police because they might provide overviews of the scene and help to ensure the protection of any physical evidence. Because this walkthrough did not happen immediately from the start of the investigation, there were numerous chances for anyone involved to contaminate evidence that could have been valuable to the case. So this includes DNA, that could be left all over the place. They just totally messed it up.
At 7:33 a.m., a canine unit with a tracking dog was put on standby, but wasn't used. Now, if the dog had been put to work immediately, there's a good chance that it would have followed the scent of JonBenet from her bed to the basement room, where her body was later found.
Patsy Ramsey changed a very important part of her story, and her statements about her initial movements were inconsistent. So this raised some doubts when investigators compared notes. She had originally told Officer French that she checked the bedroom upstairs before finding the note on the stairs. Later, she told another detective that she had gone downstairs, found the note first, and then hurried to the bedroom and found that JonBenet was missing.
So I think that's kind of suspicious.
Well, yeah. I
mean, that's not the kind of thing you'd miss up.
They're kind of minor inconsistencies in terms of which order she did things, but they're inconsistencies, and you got to be consistent.
Yes. Well, if she went to the bedroom and JonBenet wasn't there, wouldn't she go look for her right away? Or would she just assume she was in the bathroom or something, I guess?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, it's just one little thing to add to the pile of weird things.
Yeah, it's just something that's kind of out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
Now, there were no keys that had been lost or stolen. This was what John told the police. And the only people who had keys other than the immediate family were Patsy's mother and John's oldest son, both lived out of state, and their housekeeper, Linda Hoffman Pugh. So John Ramsey said that the family had returned home from the party about 10 o'clock Christmas night, and that he had read to both children before they went to sleep. Now, in later interviews, he would say that JonBenet fell asleep in the car and he carried her to bed. So he read to one kid or two kids.
Something. We don't know. Another inconsistency.
Then the Ramseys said that everyone had been in bed by 10:30 because they had a busy schedule coming up. They had to be up early to fly to Michigan, where they planned to spend a few days at their vacation home with John Ramsey's older kids. Then they were heading to Florida for a Disney cruise. Patsy said that JonBenet had gone to sleep wearing long white underwear and a red turtleneck top.
Well, Patsy stayed in the sunroom while John was pacing the dining room and the den. Police considered the distance between them to be odd. When detectives asked them who might be responsible for the disappearance of JonBenet, Patsy gave the name of her housekeeper for the past 2 years, who had the key, Linda Hoffman Pugh, who had recently asked her for a $2,000 loan. The handwriting in the ransom note, Patsy said, looked a little like the housekeeper's. The pastor told police about a phone call made that morning to Patsy's parents, Nedra and Don Powell, in Atlanta. Mrs. Powell, he said, mentioned that Linda Hoffman Pugh had commented about how beautiful JonBenet was and expressed the fear that someone might kidnap her. The housekeeper's name had come up several times in this short period of time, and police had already been told by John that she had a key. So she became the first suspect that they looked into, and police made plans to contact her right away. A second name offered was Jeff Merrick, who'd been fired by John Ramsey's company several months before, so they wrote down his name as well. 10 o'clock a.m. came and went. Detectives thought it was strange that no one, including the Ramseys, paid any attention to the deadline. Remember, the ransom note had said that kidnappers would call between 8 and 10 a.m. tomorrow. So when that would be would depend on when today is. Was it written the night before or that morning? So it could mean December 27th as easily as it would have meant December 26th. But why would the parents, if they're desperate to find out where their child is and get her back, not think that it meant that day and be waiting for something to happen by 10 a.m.?
Well, I would assume that.
I would think it would be a big deal.
Yeah. And then I would figure, if I'm the recipient of that note, they're going to call me between 8 and 10 that day.
Yes, I would think so. Why would they wait an extra day?
Right.
And anyway, even if it could be either day, I think you'd be paying attention to that time period.
Oh, absolutely.
And expecting a call during those 2 hours.
Yeah.
Unless this is all a farce. Right?
Unless.
So let's take a little pause here for our sponsors. One of my favorite beauty products is Madison Reed Hair Color. This is a company founded by a woman, Amy Arrett, in 2013, and named after her daughter. Madison Reed is on a mission to revolutionize the way that we color our hair. For as long as I can remember, there have been two hair color options, either outdated at-home color or the time and expense of getting your hair colored in a salon. Well, Madison Reed has reinvented hair color by offering us the quality of salon color with the convenience and affordability of at-home color. With Madison Reed, you'll look like you just walked out of a salon, but you'll save time and money for the things that you love. Experience beautiful, multidimensional hair color that is made in Italy and delivered to your door on your schedule for $25. Join the hundreds of thousands of women who have tried and loved Madison Reed. You can find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com, and Madison Reed is honoring our True Crime Brewery listeners with 10% off, plus free shipping on your first color kit, just by using our promo code BREWERY. That's madison-reed.com with promo code BREWERY.
Support for today's show also comes from White Boy Rick, based on the unbelievable and shocking true story of Rick Wershe Jr. This is set in 1980s Detroit at the height of the crack epidemic and the war on drugs. White Boy Rick is based on the moving, true story of a blue-collar father and his teenage son, Rick Wershe Jr. Rick starts out as a police informant, but he's soon seduced by the easy money and he becomes a dealer. Eventually, he's abandoned by his handlers and sentenced to life in prison. The movie stars Academy Award winner Matthew McConaughey in a career-redefining role, according to IGN. And Richie Merritt. White Boy Rick is directed by Yann Demange and written by Andy Weiss and Logan and Noah Miller. Don't miss White Boy Rick, rated R, now on Blu-ray and digital. Go deeper into the story with the mini-documentary, The Unknown True Story of Rick Wershe Jr., which is included in the digital and Blu-ray extras.
Great. So the bedroom of JonBenet was sealed with yellow tape, and more than 4 hours elapsed before any part of the huge house was officially designated as a crime scene. At 1 o'clock that afternoon, a detective asked Fleet White to help keep John Ramsey's mind occupied. So she suggested that they go through the house from top to bottom to see if they could find anything belonging to JonBenet. No police officer was available to go with them, which meant that these two were roaming the house unsupervised. John Ramsey headed immediately for the basement, starting at the bottom of the house instead of the top, as the officer had suggested. Fleet White followed him. The basement had many rooms, closets, and crawl spaces, and at the end of the corridor was the white door that had been checked earlier by two police officers, and also by Fleet White.
So let's think about this a little bit. We know the police are short-staffed. There's some meeting or something they have to go to, so they leave one officer in charge. This is Detective Arndt, who's never been involved in a homicide investigation.
That sounds crazy when you put it like that.
So she's left alone with a house full of people, and she suggests to John Ramsey, maybe you and your friend Fleet would like to go through the house and see if there's anything missing or see what's going on, give us a better idea. That's just beyond ridiculous. You're allowing, again, a possible suspect free range of the house.
Yeah, yeah.
So he could alter evidence, destroy evidence. He could do all sorts of things.
Well, she would later claim that this was because he was restless. It was to occupy him.
So what if he's restless?
Well, I know. And he was actually out of her sight for over an hour, I think.
Mm-hmm. So and then they go downstairs. Instead of searching, I always figured if I'm doing something like this, I'm searching from top to bottom. But Ramsey goes bottom first, almost as if he knew what he's going to find down there.
Yeah, now, yeah.
Maybe I shouldn't put it that way.
No, but, I mean, you're not the first one to think that, obviously.
So he and Fleet White go downstairs, and here's the door at the end of the corridor, the very same door that had been earlier checked by two different police officers and by Fleet White. So John Ramsey goes to this door, turns the wooden latch, opens the door, and screams, "Oh, my God, oh, my God." Fleet approached him and saw the body of JonBenet lying on her back in the small windowless room. Her arms are straight above the top of her head, outstretched. Now, earlier, when White had opened that same door, he had been unable to see anything in the Stygian darkness. And John Ramsey was kneeling beside his daughter, feeling her pale, cold face. A piece of black duct tape lay on the blanket, and a long cord was attached to her right wrist. Nearby was a pink nightgown. So White felt JonBenet's ankle, ran for help. John Ramsey picked up his daughter, who had been carefully wrapped papoose-like in a white blanket, and followed Fleet White upstairs. You can imagine what happened when they get upstairs with JonBenet's body. So Patsy was in the den with her friends when Fleet White shouted something. Priscilla White and Barbara Fernie hurried toward the sound. Patsy didn't move from the couch. So John Ramsey came up from the basement carrying the body of JonBenet, not cradle close. His hands were holding her waist. Her head was above his, facing him. Her arms were raised high, stiffened by rigor mortis, and her lips were blue. So she's obviously dead.
Yeah, there, she was.
No middle ground here.
No. No, he knew that, I'm sure. He wasn't a stupid man.
No. So a detective says to Ramsey, put the body down on the floor near the front door, and he told Fleet White to guard the basement door. Too little, too late, huh? So Detective Arndt felt the body for a neck pulse, noticed the odor of decay, and moved the body into the living room. So she lay her down on her back on a rug in front of the Christmas tree. So here's another huge error. Normally, the body should have been left untouched in the basement. It had been moved upstairs by John Ramsey, then again moved by the detective. So each time it was moved, the crime scene would change, and evidence potentially was contaminated. And this is just basic police work that they're screwing up.
Yeah, it really is. Well, then a scream came from Patsy on the other side of the house, and the detective told John to call 911, then go to his wife. He was back within 2 minutes, grabbed a blanket from a chair, and then tossed the blanket over JonBenet's body. Now, that was one of the most damaging things that could have been done, like a forensics disaster. By covering her body, John Ramsey compromised the crime scene even more. Now, any fibers left on the blanket by anyone's clothing could have been transferred from the blanket.
Certainly.
So it sounds strange to say, call 911.
Yeah, I mean, they've already called 911.
Yeah, but they don't have the radio anymore to use. They can only use the phone.
Right.
So she can't call for backup on her radio. So that's why that happened. So that actually makes a little sense.
I guess. Yeah, I know they didn't want to be on the radio so that people listening didn't know what was going on, particularly if the kidnappers were monitoring things.
Well, yeah, but that makes no sense because they already have police cars at the house. They've already blown that.
Well, totally.
Yeah.
So the other thing about this is that JonBenet's body was a crime scene and should have been off limits. And that means even to her parents, off limits.
Yes.
But John knelt beside her, stroked her hair, put his arms around her. He knelt, called her his little angel. I don't care what his motive was, he's disturbing important evidence.
Yes, yeah, someone should have been holding him back. But nobody was. Now, Patsy had to be physically supported by her friends. She was collapsing. And after reaching the body, she fell across JonBenet, adding more fiber transfers.
So we've got the blanket, the sweatshirt, and the personal close contact of the parents. All of these damaging evidence collection. Patsy rose up to her knees, lifted her arms overhead, and called out, "Jesus, you raised Lazarus from the dead. Raise my baby from the dead." So that's dramatic.
That's very dramatic.
Shortly after 2 p.m., the Ramseys left the crime scene. Patsy, clinging to family friends and sobbing hysterically, climbed into a car and was shuttled away, while John got into a separate van and also left the scene. The crime had abruptly changed from kidnapping to murder, and the place was surrounded by police. A detective sergeant was there and an FBI agent, but the parents just walked away. The various police officers who were on the scene apparently made no attempt to stop the Ramseys from leaving. And at this point, they already had Burke out of the house.
Yeah, he had been shuttled away earlier.
Yes.
To who knows where.
Without being questioned.
Right.
Now, statistically speaking, 54% of child murders are committed by family members, compared to only about 6% being committed by strangers. So the Ramseys shouldn't have been allowed to leave the scene unsupervised by police. They were the prime suspects in the investigation, but the police just let them leave. And about the same time that John Ramsey found JonBenet's body, a detective found a possible practice ransom note in a tablet that belonged to Patsy Ramsey. He asked for handwriting samples from John and Patsy, which is standard procedure, to begin eliminating people as authors of the note. John Ramsey picked up two tablets of white-lined paper, one from a countertop and the other from a hallway table, and handed them to the policemen. Both pads were taken to the police department and given to the forgery and fraud investigator. They were apparently written on the same kind of paper as the ransom note. And in the middle of Patsy's notepad, there was a page with Mr. and Mrs. and then a forward slash written on it. Now, this was a single vertical line that could have been the downstroke you would use to start a capital letter R. It looked like the start of another ransom note, and it was in a tablet belonging to Patsy Ramsey. So this is extremely incriminating.
Isn't it?
At the Ramsey house, a detective overheard John Ramsey on the telephone at 1:40 p.m. telling his pilot to prepare his plane for a flight to Atlanta. Now, he was soon told to cancel the flight, but, of course, police found this suspicious that he was doing that.
Well, yeah.
I saw in an interview that he said Atlanta's where they're from. Their family was there, and he wanted to return home. So he wanted to go to Atlanta to be with his family.
So before JonBenet's body was removed from the house, the blanket that had been covering her was removed from her upper torso and the sweatshirt from her feet.
Yeah, I don't know who put the sweatshirt over her feet, but somebody did.
She wore a white long-sleeved shirt with a star of silver sequins on the chest and long john pants that appeared to be urine stained. When her body was turned over, police saw that a garrote was knotted tightly around her neck. This had been made from a thin cord tied to a narrow wooden stick that was about 4 inches long and splotched with colors, broken at one end, which had been used as a handle. A gold necklace and cross, which had been a Christmas present to JonBenet, were wrapped up in the garrote. Abrasions were noted below her right earlobe and right jawline. There was a small amount of blood around her nose. White cord similar to the garrote was still tied around her right wrist. There were also small bits of lint and dust on her bare feet, and her blonde hair was in pigtails.
Okay, so is this a good point for you to go over the autopsy report? I know you have it there.
I do.
So what's your overall opinion on it?
Well, there's a couple things.
Okay.
What they hadn't noticed right away was that she had a significant head injury. So, and she had fracture on the right side of her skull, and this caused bleeding on her brain. And then she had the strangulation.
So what was it that killed her? What was the cause of death determined to be?
So the cause of death was determined to be strangulation. That was also associated with craniocerebral trauma. Now, from what I've read and seen about this case, the head injury would have killed her eventually. So the idea is that the head injury occurred first, and then she was strangled. But if whoever had done this had waited a short time, the head injury would have killed her. So she was likely unconscious, or more than likely, she was unconscious at the time that she was strangled.
Well, and some things at the crime scene would also go along with that, like the fact that the way she was tied wouldn't have held a conscious child.
Right.
It wouldn't have restrained her.
I mean, it was what they described as a slipknot around her wrist, so she could have easily gotten her hands free.
Which leads us to believe that that was all just a distraction to mislead police.
And the other things that were noticed on autopsy was that she had had some trauma to the vaginal area. Now, it doesn't, from the report, it's not as if she had been sexually abused, just that there were signs that at least the outside of her genital area had been wiped or struck or something like that. So the guess, this isn't from the autopsy report, but the guess from people that look through it is that this bedwetting that JonBenet did enraged Patsy, and she would be rough when cleaning the child up. And that's how she got the genital trauma.
Well, yeah, it's important to note that this was chronic trauma. It wasn't just something that happened that night.
Right.
But they also found some microscopic wood slivers in some of the tissue.
They did. That probably was from the garage.
So how would that get down there?
I don't know how the bits of wood got there.
Okay, so nobody knows about that.
Nobody knows.
But there's nothing that clearly would point to sexual abuse.
No.
No.
And her pediatrician, who, as we said, had seen her numerous times, says that there was never any evidence of sexual abuse.
Okay, but normally you don't check that area on a six-year-old or a younger child.
Unless that's a chief complaint.
Right, exactly.
Right. I know.
So okay.
We'll take that maybe with a grain of salt.
Sure. So technicians then begin a 10-day search of the house, but the crime scene was obviously contaminated by having so many people there. Evidence such as the ransom note, the body, the suitcase in the basement, and the tape that covered JonBenet's mouth had all been moved. A technician went through the house slowly with a video camera before JonBenet's body was removed. On the stair landing just outside JonBenet's bedroom were a washer and dryer and some small cabinets. And the door of one cabinet was wide open with a large package of pull-up diapers hanging halfway off the shelf. On the bathroom counter, there was a balled-up child's red turtleneck sweater. So although Patsy said JonBenet went to bed wearing a red turtleneck, her body was discovered in the same white pullover that she had worn to the party the evening before.
And so what's with that?
Yeah, who changed her clothes?
And also downstairs in the basement, another technician was examining the broken window. Remember, this is a window or the glass and so on that Fleet White had found.
Yes, yep.
So there were three windows that were each measured 18 by 30 inches in a row. The top left pane in the center window was broken, and the screen was off. Now, the tech noticed pieces of glass outside the window and a scuff mark on the wall. The dust, film, and debris on the windowsill were undisturbed. Outside, a detective examined the steel grate that covered the window and found undisturbed cobwebs still attached from the grate to the bricks, and the bushes around the grate also looked undisturbed. In a far corner of the basement, just outside the small room where JonBenet's body had been found, a detective found six oil paintings and a plastic tote that belonged to Patsy. In the tote, there was a broken brush splattered with paint, and there were splinters on the floor beside the tote. So this was a big find, because the broken brush matched the broken end of the multicolored stick that had been used to make the garrote.
So now we have two direct connections between Patsy and this crime. We have a connection between Patsy and the ransom note, and a connection between Patsy and the garrote.
Yeah. Although we don't have real confirmation of the ransom note yet, that it likely was written by Patsy, just that the handwriting was kind of similar.
Well, and not even considering the handwriting, the point that it was her notepad.
Right. Yes, you're right.
And that there was a possible practice note in her notepad. So the detective had found the source of part of the murder weapon and where it had been broken. Because the detective had touched JonBenet's body, another technician collected her jeans and black blouse. So it was important to take the clothing from the detective because fibers from her clothing
would be used for elimination purposes against any fibers discovered on the body. But when you think of all the people and everything that happened, it really is a forensic nightmare.
Isn't it? So while they're doing this, no one bothered to collect the clothing that had been worn by either of the Ramseys, and both of them had been in contact, direct contact, with JonBenet's body. A huge legal fight would ensue over the following months as police tried to get custody of their clothing, particularly Patsy's red turtleneck sweater, her black and red checked blazer, and her fur coats. And they fought that. The Ramseys fought that like crazy.
Took a long time.
Took a forever time.
So police also canvassed the neighborhood. There was an elderly couple across the street who said they had seen John Ramsey's older son and JonBenet's half-brother John Andrew Ramsey at the Ramsey home on Christmas Day. On the afternoon of December 28, 1996, police allowed entry to the house to one of Patsy Ramsey's sisters from Atlanta, Pam Paugh, so that she could get clothing for Patsy, John, and Burke to wear to JonBenet's funeral. Accompanied by Detective Mike Evert, Paugh spent hours making at least a half a dozen trips throughout that house to take a large amount of the Ramseys' possessions out of the police car. So it's not like she walked in with a policeman and took two outfits out of the closet.
Oh, no.
She
collected stuff.
She had reign of that household. She was all over the place.
Yeah.
And that police car was chock-a-block full of possessions.
It was.
So it's a huge mistake in police procedure because absolutely nothing should be removed from an active crime scene, especially still so early in the investigation. It's only been 2 days. So she never should have been given authorization to even enter the home. The things she removed included stuffed animals from JonBenet's bedroom, dresses for JonBenet, tiaras, passports, bank records, toys for Burke, clothing, jewelry, and credit cards. I mean, I almost feel like if I didn't know better, and I don't necessarily know better, that John Ramsey had something on the police department. Why are they letting this happen?
I don't know. The other thing, and it sounds like the stuff she took was things that had been directed for her to take.
By
the Ramseys. So, Pam, I want you to go to our house and gather these things.
Wow, is all I can say to that.
But I'm just astounded that they were allowed to get in the house and take stuff.
What about the passports?
Well, they stayed.
They did, yeah. Okay, well, I guess we've really hammered home how the investigation was botched. I don't want to keep beating a dead horse over that. So let's go over the possibilities and probabilities of how JonBenet ended up dead in her basement. One theory focuses on Patsy as JonBenet's killer. It was rumored in the months leading up to her death that JonBenet had started to pursue her independence and that she was testing the patience of her parents. Since JonBenet suffered from some bedwetting, the theory is that JonBenet had wet herself the night she was killed, and that was the last straw scenario for Patsy. So Patsy, stressed and annoyed at having to clean her up, then physically attacked or struck JonBenet. So it would be kind of an accidental killing, but she actually would have killed her by her own hand in that scenario.
She would have.
The chief coroner and medical examiner, Dr. Robert Brissy, concluded that the cause of JonBenet's death was strangulation along with a head injury that occurred shortly before. Patsy could have impulsively hit JonBenet in the head with a heavy object, knocking her unconscious. So this injury was probably fatal, you said, right?
Yeah, that's the impression that would have killed her.
Okay. And Patsy, maybe she was too frightened to take JonBenet to the hospital or call for help, so she chose to cover it up. So according to this theory, Patsy took the time to fabricate a false kidnapping in order to cover up what had happened.
Yeah. So here's this kid with a serious head injury who's comatose, probably dying. And so Patsy's going to cover up this accidental, or possibly accidental thing. Maybe not accidental, but...
but not meant to kill her.
Right.
But the thing with that is, I don't think that you hit a child that hard unless you've already been abusive in the past. That's not a smack.
That's a good point. Well, it was the flashlight, they think?
Well, yeah. In that documentary I was talking about, they said that the flashlight fit exactly into the fracture of JonBenet's skull.
Yeah.
So he thought that was the probable
weapon. It has
weapon.
To be delivered with a good amount of force.
Yeah, yeah. But it was a heavy flashlight.
So that's the theory.
That's one theory.
And then when you analyze the handwriting of the ransom note, John Ramsey was cleared of the possibility of having written the note. But Patsy could not be eliminated. So a handwriting expert from the Colorado Bureau of Investigation concluded that the handwriting samples showed characterizations that the writer of the ransom note was none other than Patsy Ramsey.
Yes, and we've seen this examination. It definitely does look like her handwriting.
Oh, it does.
And then possession and another word, business, were misspelled. But there were other, more sophisticated words, I would argue, that were spelled correctly.
Yeah, so it's like they're trying to throw the reader off.
Yes, seems like that. But, you know, it's really hard to write that much stuff and hide who you are, hide your own writing tendencies, your own wording of things.
Right. Well, in the book we read, they had an expert, a linguistics expert from New York, who was testified that the syntax of the note was Patsy's.
Yeah, yeah. There were some things that indicated it was a female.
Right.
Right. There were a lot of things that indicated it could have been her. Also, we have the amount of the ransom, which you mentioned briefly. $118,000 was pretty much the exact amount that John Ramsey had received as his Christmas bonus from his company. So this suggests that the person who wrote the note had knowledge of this. Also, typically, kidnappers are greedy and will demand a much larger sum of ransom.
Well, sure. I mean, the Ramseys, John Ramsey, he was worth millions. So it's kind of odd to the police, anyway, that whoever had written the note was demanding such a small ransom when compared to the wealth of the family.
Yes. So let's touch upon the unknown intruder as the killer. I know neither of us really believe that, but I think we need to touch upon it as a possibility, because we don't know.
We don't.
So the note was evidence that would suggest an unrelated kidnapper, if you're taking it at face value, but the details, of course, didn't add up for investigators. The FBI stated that the leaving of a nearly 3-page ransom note was something that had never been seen before in any other kidnapping investigation. Ransom notes are usually very short and concise, with just enough details to make their point.
Well, yeah, particularly in this case, the paper for the note came from paper in the house, and the writing implement was from a pen in the house.
Yes.
So it's pretty much figured that the kidnapper or perpetrator wrote the note in the house.
Yes.
So if that's the case, who's going to write a 2.5-page note while you could be discovered at any time? There's other occupants in the house.
I know.
That are ostensibly asleep, but who knows?
Well, and what about the rough draft, the practice note?
Well, it's not definitively a rough draft.
True.
It just, you know, when you can look at the total thing, the note itself, and those first few characters, does suggest that it was a practice note.
Mm-hmm. Well, just imagine going to do a kidnapping and deciding that you're going to not bring your own note or even your own paper or pen. You're not going to bring any weapons. You're going to use something that you just happened to find in the basement. And if you wanted to kidnap her, why would you even go to the basement? There'd be much easier ways to leave that house with her. The alarm system was not on.
It would have been difficult if he'd gained entrance to the house through that broken window.
Well, very difficult. I've seen some reenactments trying to do it, and it's really very small. You can do it, but not without disturbing things that were there.
And this is just gaining entrance. How about trying to exit with an unconscious child?
Yeah. No, it really doesn't make sense. So to experts, whoever had written that note had been trying to hide their educational background, to make themselves appear as maybe they were foreign, because it said foreign faction. And we know the police confirmed that there were no signs of forced entry on any of the doors or windows.
Right. The broken window had been broken by John months before. He'd locked himself out of the house.
That's right, yeah.
So he had broken that window to gain entrance to the house and never bothered to repair the window.
So if it wasn't a family member, it had to be someone who had a key. Or at least had access to make a copy of a key.
Now, the Ramseys, they did have a burglary alarm system, but they rarely used it. Now, I can tell you from experience, if I have an alarm system, by God, I'm going to use it.
Sure, especially when you go to bed at night.
That sucker is on.
Right.
When we're both here and not here.
And if you have two small children and you're that wealthy, I find it odd. Now, early in the investigation, Patsy suggested the possibility of the housekeeper, remember, as a suspect, because the housekeeper had a key to the house. And Patsy recalled that in the months leading up to Christmas, the housekeeper had asked for $2,000 from the Ramseys to help her pay her rent. Now, another time, she said that the housekeeper made an offhand comment, wondering if the Ramseys were ever worried about someone kidnapping JonBenet because she was such a beautiful child. But there was no evidence ever found that the housekeeper was a real suspect. I don't see someone asking to borrow $2,000 as someone who's going to kidnap a child and ask for $118,000.
No, it's true. Then we have another guy, potential suspect, Bill McReynolds. He was a friend of the Ramseys, and he dressed up as Santa Claus. And he'd done this for a while. He was maybe not a legend, but he was famous for doing his Santa Claus.
The annual Christmas parties, yeah. Right.
So the week before JonBenet's murder, he had been in the Ramsey home to entertain the neighborhood children at one of Patsy's Christmas gatherings. So certainly think of an older man dressed as Santa being a pretty good suspect in a sexualized child murder. The possibility that McReynolds, who died, and he was in poor health, the idea that he had anything to do with JonBenet's death is very unlikely.
Yeah, he was a little odd.
He had an alibi. He was home with his wife. She backed that up.
And he was kind of frail.
And he was pretty frail. So the idea that he would drive 40 miles to the Ramsey house, sneak in,
and get her down the basement and everything?
Right.
Not bloody likely. But he was rumored to have paid a little too much attention to JonBenet, going so far as to arrange a secret visit from Santa on Christmas. Now that could just be something you say to a child, right?
Sure.
I'll be there on Christmas. You're Santa. Now supposedly he had chosen JonBenet to be his special friend, going so far as to bring some glitter that she had given him into him with heart surgery. Even stranger, he did ask his wife to mix this gold glitter in with his ashes when he died. So this particular story, when it hit the Denver Post, got a lot of attention. But it really didn't amount to anything more than a character assassination of maybe a little bit strange of an old guy.
Yeah.
Not that strange.
Kind of creepy.
Well, it depends how you look at it, I guess.
Yeah. Then what about the older brother, Burke?
Yes, now the documentary I was talking about with Jim Clemente, that was the conclusion they drew with Burke. Several other experts, that Burke was the killer.
Yeah, so John and Patsy did shield Burke from the press for years after the murder. And judging from a very strange interview that Burke eventually did with Dr. Phil, that was probably a good idea.
Well, according to Dr. Phil, Burke was kind of an socially awkward guy because he was kept away from the public. He didn't go to public school. He wasn't around people. He works from home. So when he was interviewed by Dr. Phil, he was smiling the whole time. And a lot of people had a lot to say about that. Dr. Phil himself felt that it was just nervousness and awkwardness, which I can see. I can see that.
Yeah, I can. And we have some reports that he could be abusive towards JonBenet. He went after her with a golf club one time.
Yes.
But my difficulty, I suppose a 9-year-old could do that. I mean, a 9-year-old wouldn't set out to try to kill his sister necessarily.
Right.
He'd try to hurt her.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Then if the flashlight is, in fact, the weapon that caused the head trauma, I can't picture a 9-year-old little boy swinging it with sufficient force to do the damage it did.
Yes, well, they addressed that in the documentary. Now, soon after Burke, when he was 29, the 20-year anniversary of the killing, was interviewed by Dr. Phil, CBS aired the documentary, The Case of JonBenet Ramsey, and that was when they reinvestigated the evidence with that group of FBI and forensic experts, including retired profiler Jim Clemente. Now, the CBS team set up the theory that Burke had done it. And that's when Werner Spitz's review of JonBenet's autopsy included that there was a perfectly rectangular defect that he suspected came from a blow to her head with a blunt, heavy flashlight that was actually seen in a photo on the kitchen counter in the crime scene photos. And he claimed that this flashlight did fit the 8.5-inch gash in her skull to perfection. That's a big gash.
That's a huge gash.
So that's a big flashlight.
Well, and again, it has to be swung with pretty significant force.
Yes, but if he hit her a few months ago with a golf club and she was okay, he might have whacked her with the flashlight thinking that it's not going to kill her. That might not have even entered his mind.
Right, but then I would submit that he wouldn't have been able to hit her hard enough to cause the damage that was caused.
Okay, but they would disagree with you in that documentary from what they came up with. But I think that's a valid thing, too. Now, interestingly enough, there's no trace evidence that was found from either JonBenet or Burke on that flashlight. So if that was the weapon, somebody cleaned it up. The flashlight theory comes into play when you tie it to the pineapple scenario. So the pineapple found on the table, the pineapple, did you mention that in the autopsy?
I did not.
So there was pineapple found in her stomach, partially digested. So she must have eaten it that night.
She must have eaten it that night because there wasn't any pineapple served at the White's house where the family was partying. The idea is that they got home and at some point JonBenet wanted something to eat.
Yes, so. Because the food that she ate at the party had already been digested and it was just the pineapple in her stomach. So the scenario that they had was that Burke was sitting down to have a snack. There was a teacup and there was a bowl of pineapple with a spoon. So if Burke was having that snack and JonBenet woke up and walked by and grabbed a piece of his pineapple, that would be when he whacked her with the flashlight. And then the parents, thinking that they have already lost one child, they don't want to lose their son too, did this whole elaborate cover-up.
There was, I think, more than one piece of pineapple found in JonBenet's stomach.
Okay.
So the idea that she took a single piece while he was eating it, and he got enraged and struck her, and she had more than a single piece.
I wasn't sure they could tell the amount.
They could look at the pieces of pineapple. They obviously been chewed up and swallowed.
Yes.
But they can get an idea how many pieces she had ingested.
But you're sure it's more than one piece? You're sure about that?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm still saying that he couldn't have hit her that hard.
Okay. What about the wounds on JonBenet's back? So some people have proposed that that was from a stun gun, these two marks on her back. Now, from everything that we've looked into, these were not consistent with the marks you'd get from a stun gun.
Yeah, but this is going back to the intruder theory.
Yes. Well, I only went to that because what Werner Spitz came up with is that those marks were actually from the edges of one of Burke's toy train tracks. And he thinks that if Burke hit her in the head and she was unconscious, he may have poked her in the back with the train tracks, trying to get a response from her.
Yeah, although on the autopsy, there's just some abrasions on the right shoulder and left lower back.
Right.
That doesn't have anything in particular written about it. And then she has left leg abrasions.
But I mean, all that could just be from moving her, I would imagine.
Sure.
She's moved to the basement.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're not buying into the Burke did it scenario.
I just don't. I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry. Well, it was after that special aired that Burke actually filed a $150 million lawsuit against Spitz for defamatory statements that he made about Burke in that special. So another suspect is Gary Oliva. This is a 32-year-old known sex offender in Boulder, Colorado. And he was there when JonBenet was found strangled to death in what looked like a sexual assault. And this convicted pedophile had been living in the area on and off when police allegedly found a magazine cutout of JonBenet Ramsey in his backpack after he was arrested on drug charges in the year 2000. And he was released, but there were some suspicions that did remain against him. His high school friend Michael Vail came forward with an allegation. Vail claimed that not long after the murder, Oliva had called him and confessed to him that he hurt a little girl. Vail told In Touch magazine that he was unsettled by how the knots used to fashion the garrote that strangled JonBenet were similar to those used in an incident where Oliva attempted to choke his mother with a telephone cord.
How does he know that? So Vail saw Oliva trying to choke his mother and he just remembered that the knots in the garage were similar to the knots in the telephone cord?
That I don't know.
Come on.
I mean, police ruled him out anyway.
That just goes beyond.
It does, but I think it's important to mention everybody that was suspected.
Sure. And can I do one more thing about the stun gun, since we've talked about that?
Sure, yeah. Please.
The demonstrations we've seen, you'd think the stun gun, boom, you get hit with it, and you're down and out. But it hurts like hell. So if someone had used a stun gun on her, if you're going to use a stun gun, she's going to jump out of bed and start screaming.
Yes, yep. We did see a few demonstrations like that.
Right, and the marks that were found on her body don't really compare to the marks that I saw when they did a stun gun demonstration on a volunteer.
Not at all. No, you're right.
So I don't like the stun gun theory.
No. Well, and the stun gun theory goes along with an intruder, which I don't think you like the intruder theory either.
No, as implausible as these other suspects are, to me the intruder aspect is the most unlikely.
Right. Well, another potential suspect was an electrician named Michael Helgoth, who worked in a nearby auto salvage yard. Helgoth was tied to an alleged property dispute involving the Ramseys. So it's been speculated that once Helgoth heard that he could be a suspect in the case, he committed suicide before anyone could get to him. And the whole connection here was a boot print that was allegedly similar to his that was found near the Ramsey home. Now, his suicide occurred 2 days after a 1997 press release announced that the Boulder DA was zeroing in on a new suspect. Now, he was cleared by DNA, but I don't think DNA really is going to solve this case.
No, there's so much DNA that can be recovered there. It's not going to be useful at all.
Well, and if the DNA found on JonBenet's clothing is touch DNA, and it hasn't been connected to anyone, they have tested hundreds of people.
They have, and nobody's matched.
So other theories are that it was a mixture of people's DNA, which I guess that can happen with touch DNA.
Right, and the other thing is that they only looked at 5 different points.
Yeah, they didn't cover all the points.
There was a DNA expert that said that typically you would look at 12 points.
Yeah, so why is that?
And they only went with 5, which increases the probability that more than one person can have those points.
There's also the suggestion that the DNA could have come from production of the garments.
So, a police person at the scene, a neighbor or friend of the family that had been at the scene.
When they came out and said that the Ramsey family was cleared because of DNA, that was just ridiculous.
Yeah, because it didn't clear them.
No.
The most sensational suspect probably was John Mark Carr. This is a former school teacher that in 2006 confessed to strangling JonBenet in graphic sexual detail. Now, Carr was arrested in Thailand, where he'd been living on the lam after facing child pornography charges in the United States. He initially brought himself into view by reaching out to a University of Colorado professor named Michael Tracy over email in regards to a documentary Tracy was making on a case. Once these emails took a disturbing turn, which was revealing the grown man's sexual fascination with JonBenet, Tracy reported Carr to the police, who arrested him in Bangkok as a possible suspect. So he gets flown to Boulder for questioning, but he was also ultimately cleared after his DNA failed to match the profile of an unknown male found on the waistband of JonBenet's long johns.
Well, sure, but he really... It was kind of ludicrous that they brought him in and made such a big deal. I mean, there was speculation that the DA should not have given him so much attention. He loved the attention. Plus, he was saying that he was having sex with her and accidentally strangled her. The head injury wasn't even mentioned.
No, he's basically a liar.
He's really a disgusting pedophile.
Yes.
Yeah, he's really gross. Now, his confession involved a series of diary entries that were allegedly written from the scene of the crime. In one account, he recalled strangling JonBenet in a love game gone wrong. How fucking gross is that?
Gross enough that I think he ought to be in jail forever anyway.
Yeah, I agree. But he was ultimately dismissed.
Right. Because one of the things, they could never verify that he was ever in Boulder.
Exactly, so. Yeah.
Can't do the crime if you're not present.
That's true.
So in 1997, Boulder Police Chief and Boulder County District Attorney held a news conference. And in this conference, they vowed that the killer would be brought to justice. They announced the formation of an expert prosecution task force, including forensic expert Henry Lee and DNA expert Barry Scheck.
Yeah, Henry Lee was in that special, too, that I keep going back to.
So, and according to Detective Steve Thomas, who is the author of one of the books we read about this case, Barry Scheck came to the conclusion that the unknown DNA found on JonBenet's waistband was likely a contaminant.
Yeah, so Henry Lee believed that, Barry Scheck believed that. A lot of people thought that that DNA really didn't have the significance that it was given by the DA.
Right. And then a team of experts did eventually conclude that they weren't at all certain that the male DNA sample was even a profile of an individual person. This is what you had mentioned. It could likely have been a mixture of multiple people's DNA, investigator Kevin Vaughn told NBC News in 2016. So based on the actual testing, there is no way to know for sure that this DNA got there during the killing, belonged to the killer, or anything like that.
Yeah. So this Steve Thomas, he was very angry about the whole Boulder Police Department and how they dealt with this. They kind of dealt with it, well, D.A. Hunter dealt with it as a political issue. More than a year after JonBenet was murdered, the Ramseys finally turned over their clothing that they were wearing the night before JonBenet was found dead. Now, how do we know that's the right clothing? It could have been washed so many times.
How do we know it wasn't washed or dry cleaned or whatever?
Yeah.
Come on.
Never heard of such a thing. After looking for the killer of JonBenet for 15 months, police said that the best bet for solving the murder was to have a grand jury investigation. And that's when they formally called for the probe after they conferred with the DA, Alex Hunter. In his 8-page resignation letter, angry Detective Steve Thomas said that D.A. Hunter's office was thoroughly compromised and had crippled the case. Thomas charged critical evidence had not been collected, and he maintained that there was other evidence that was never even tested. Now, to me, the most alarming thing was when D.A. Alex Hunter announced, after the grand jury completed its work, that his team did not think it had sufficient evidence to warrant filing of charges. So that would lead you to believe that the grand jury decided not to indict anyone, wouldn't it?
One would think.
And I think that's what everybody thought.
But
I think he was purposely misleading people.
Well, he had said all along that the ultimate decision on whether to file charges against the Ramseys was his decision.
Sure, but it's virtually unheard of for a grand jury to want to indict and the DA saying no.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's why you have the grand jury.
Exactly.
And this grand jury was impaneled for over a year.
I can't even imagine,
so,
yeah.
How would you feel if you just spent over a year of your life listening to testimony and your decision is to indict the parents of the child and the DA says, nah, we're not going to do that. Not only says we're not going to do it, he says there's not sufficient evidence to warrant filing of charges.
True.
Boy, I'd be pissed.
Yeah. Now, these weren't murder indictments, though.
Right.
In 2013, the documents were released, and they showed that the grand jury indictment in 1999 accused John and Patsy Ramsey of 2 counts each of child abuse resulting in the death of their daughter. And the charges alleged that the parents permitted JonBenet to be placed in a dangerous situation that led to her death and accused them of helping her killer. So here's again where the Burke thing comes into play.
Yeah, but you could also say that they did this because they weren't sure which Ramsey did it.
Good point, Dick.
So
yeah.
They're going to word it that way and hopefully at trial figure out who was the perpetrator.
And at least get them on child abuse.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, you still have the idea of Burke with the parents covering it up. So you have the idea of...
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the next most plausible thing.
So what's the first most plausible thing?
It's one of the parents did it, and one of the parents specifically being Patsy.
And this is with the losing her temper, hitting her in the head?
Yes.
Okay, but if that's the case, then you must necessarily believe that she was abusive to JonBenet before, because that kind of thing doesn't just happen.
Not to that degree, right?
Right.
So I would agree with that.
Okay.
That she was likely abused at some point. We know that She was starting to talk back to her mother about the beauty pageants and stuff.
Right.
And we know, like, that that evening, Patsy said that they like to dress up together in similar outfits. And when they were going to the White's party on Christmas, JonBenet didn't want to dress up as her mother and pitched a little tantrum.
Yes.
So that would piss Patsy off.
Right. Because Patsy wanted things to look perfect to everybody.
But I think Patsy probably used some physical punishment on JonBenet in the past.
Yeah. Well, just let me go back to the Burke thing for a second. Because he did hit JonBenet with a golf club 6 months before JonBenet was killed. And in interviews, Judith Phillips, the family photographer, has said that Burke was jealous of JonBenet, and he was a kid with a chip on his shoulder. She said that Patsy told her that JonBenet had a mark on her head because Burke lost his temper and struck her with the golf club. A former housekeeper told investigators that Burke had a problem where he would smear feces on the walls as well. And there had been a ball of feces found in JonBenet's bed before. Another little tidbit on this is after the crime scene technicians sealed off JonBenet's room, they found that there was feces spread on a box of candy that she had gotten the day before Christmas. So could Burke have held some resentments against her that he showed with this feces smearing behavior and by hitting her?
I could just as easily argue that it was JonBenet who smeared the feces on the box of candy.
Right, that's true.
And we know that she had some stooling problems, so the ball of feces found in her bed could come from her.
Okay. Well, because the DA, DA Hunter, refused to sign the documents from the grand jury, the Ramseys were never officially indicted or prosecuted. And he made a statement that they didn't have enough evidence to indict anyone in the case. So this case is unsolved, and it will probably never be solved.
No, it won't be. Unless John Ramsey confesses at some point.
Yeah,
That his wife did it.
And I don't see that happening.
It's never going to happen.
Patsy herself died of ovarian cancer in 2006, and John remarried a fashion designer named Jan Russo in 2011, and she's his third wife.
Yeah. So the scenario, and I don't want to sound like a copycat, but the book written by Thomas, the detective, right? That's his name?
Steve Thomas.
His scenario is that they get home, JonBenet's in bed, in the clothes that she'd been wearing, and she wet the bed. So Patsy comes in and cleans up, takes the red sweater off, and puts the white Sarth shirt on.
Well, and that would explain why JonBenet's red sweater was balled up in the bathroom.
By the washing machine.
And the pull-ups package was hanging out of the cabinet.
Right. And then she gets pissed off. And I don't know, maybe this is when JonBenet had been eating some pineapple or something, but...
So you think she took her downstairs for a snack and the pineapple was for JonBenet?
I do. And she's still pissed at her. And maybe JonBenet is mouthing off or something. So she grabs a flashlight and smacks her one.
That's just hard to imagine, a mother doing that. But I know it happens, yeah.
And then panics, as we've said. So she concocts this idea of strangling, staging the body and stuff like that.
So here's my big question. When does John come into this picture?
I think he was there fairly early. I can't believe that she did all this stuff overnight and then woke him up in the morning and said, "Dear, I've done a horrible thing." Or he gets up and finds out what's happened.
So you think he was awake when this happened?
Yes.
Okay.
Again, this is...
It's just such a strange plan to come up with. If you wanted to hide that, why wouldn't you just call 911 and say she fell down the stairs or something? I don't know. It's crazy.
Yeah, well, I don't think they thought they could get away with that statement.
Well, they probably couldn't have.
So, but I think that he was probably awake at some point and assisted in covering it up. I think he probably helped write the ransom note.
The note was so stupid, though. I mean, wasn't it just stupid? Why not just write like three sentences on a strange piece of paper?
Yeah.
And then why leave the pineapple there? I guess they didn't even consider the pineapple would become an issue.
No, probably not. Yeah, I suppose it could be Burke. I just don't see it being him being able to generate sufficient force to cause the head trauma that he did. But his fingerprints and Patsy's fingerprints are on the bowl of pineapple.
Yes.
So that could point more to Burke.
It could.
I don't know. I still think Patsy's the likely perpetrator.
Okay. But we're totally throwing out the intruder idea.
There's pretty much zero doubt in my mind.
I agree.
That there is an intruder in the house.
Yeah.
There's just so many things that would have to go right for an intruder to be in play here. I can't see it happening.
And the whole crime makes no sense for an intruder to do.
Yeah. I mean, if you've gone to the trouble of kidnapping, you've arranged this kidnapping, or you've kidnapped her, you've got her subdued, why do you kill her?
And if you're a pedophile, if this is a sex crime, this is not how they operate. They would take her away from the house.
Yeah. So I don't believe that there's an intruder.
So we're going either Patsy or Burke.
Yes.
I think I'm pretty much on board with you. Probably Patsy, but I can see the Burke thing happening also. We don't know that much about what kind of a kid he was. He was 9, and that was a big, heavy flashlight. It's definitely possible. And kids hit each other.
Yeah, I guess I would go back to saying it's possible but not probable.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm told that other experts say that it could have been.
Well,
but I'm just thinking that that was a horrific head injury.
Sure was. And
whoever did that swung pretty hard.
I just can't picture anyone doing that as the problem,
yeah,
you know?
That's
I can't
true.
Picture her mother,
that's
her brother, anyone.
You can't see Patsy doing it
it's
either.
It's just horrific. I mean, if she really lost her temper, why wouldn't she just have hit her?
Yeah.
You know, or walk away. That's so extreme.
And just one other thing. I mean, there's nothing recovered from the flashlight, so nobody's certain that that's the weapon.
No.
I mean, Dr. Spitz said, well, it looks perfect.
He did.
But, I mean, it could have been that Patsy pushed her or threw her and she hit her head on the countertop or something. But I don't see how this 9-year-old little kid could have swung with that much force. But
well, it would be extreme, but I also think if Patsy did it, it would be extreme.
Yeah, but she's an adult.
Yes.
She's able to put more force into it.
That's true.
But, and then, well, she's dying, and they're figuring, oh, God, we can't take her to the hospital, because...
But come on, if that's your child, you're going to cling to hope and call 911.
Well, they don't think that way.
Well, they're really messed up, then.
They're a well-renowned, wealthy family.
They're very into appearances.
And having a dead child wouldn't fit their image.
No. Well, at least not that they killed.
Right.
Right.
Whether accidentally or not, whether they could even spin it as an accident in the home, they'd still be known as the parents of the dead girl.
Well, I mean, they're still known as the parents of the dead girl.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going with the Patsy did it generally.
Yeah, I probably sound like a broken record.
Yeah.
Because that's the general consensus.
Well, from the things we've read and watched, I have to say that Steve Thomas's book, he convinced me a lot. And he was involved in the case and knew it quite well, so...
He worked it from the onset.
Yeah. So to me, even though you might have experts going over the case, someone who's an expert and was actually involved, to me, I give more credit to, more credence to what they think. Well, it's definitely a sad case.
Yeah, it is. You know, the sad thing to me is that this cute little 6-year-old is dead and no one knows for sure how that occurred.
Yeah, and she became this big sensationalized story, which she was just a kid.
Yeah, who just wanted to do kid things.
Right, exactly. Well, thanks for talking to me about this. And because of the holiday, we're not doing any feedback today. The music for True Crime Brewery was written and produced by Tristan Capel, and we'll be back next week with a new episode that will include feedback. So please keep sending your emails and calling in with your voicemails. We really appreciate
voicemails.
That.
Voicemails. You've got... a week and a half left to get those voicemails in.
And get a free t-shirt.
For your free t-shirt.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Happy holidays. And we'll see you next time at The Quiet End.
You bet. Bye.